Sports Report. And now your host, John Friend.
All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. The website is therealistreport.com, where you can find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other programs I have appeared on as a guest over the years. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, a contact page, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also write for The Barnes Review, the bi-monthly history magazine affiliated with American Free Press. As always, I encourage listeners to subscribe to both publications if they are not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for subscription details. Okay, with that said, let me introduce my special guest today. Monica Schaefer is joining us once again. Monica is a courageous activist, musician, and writer, and I'm so happy to have her join us today. Monica, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Thank you so much, John. I am doing very well, and I am delighted to be on your program once again.
Yes, thank you so much for taking the time. You were last, I guess, and I guess it was the first and only time you've been on the program, so I'm glad to have you back. But our first conversation was in May of this year, and we had a very good talk about your background, your history, your views on the Holocaust, and a number of other subjects. It was a really good podcast, and I hope people go back and check that out if they missed that one, because it was really good. And I guess just to kind of get started, how are you? How is your brother? Your brother has also been a guest on The Realist Report, and I know you guys pretty much see eye to eye on a lot of these topics. So how have you been? Also, I heard him with Andrew Carrington Hitchcock. That was a great show. I love both those guys.
Yes, that was actually a really good show. That was not that long ago. And Alfred is doing very well. His spirit is really high. He is just going full force straight ahead. Most recently, he gave a 10-minute talk, short but very to the point, at the Rheinwiesen. This is where these death camps happened after official hostilities ended in 1945, where probably somewhere around 1.5 million Germans were killed, murdered, starved to death in these camps alone, in addition to the millions of other Germans who were killed after hostilities end, which official history doesn't teach us about, but this is what happened. And he gave a talk there, broke all the speech laws and even the gesture laws, and introduced his speech, though, saying the police are here to protect us, not to shut us down. And after his speech, he went through the line of police, smiling and greeting them friendly, and they greeted him right back. So really, there is a shift in the zeitgeist now, a very perceptible shift, and it is going in our favor. And this is definitely what Alfred's take on it is. And I think that's a good segue into the situation with Ursula Haverbeck, because she also is not in jail, as many people will think, because the mainstream media wants us to believe that she is sitting in jail. They keep reporting about, oh yeah, okay, 10 months or 6 months or 14 months that she's been sentenced with. But there is endless process of appeals. And I would just like to share with you what the judge a few weeks ago said when the judge handed down a 6-month sentence. This judge said, well, I have to do this. It's the law. I have to give you this minimum sentence of 6 months. But I know that it's meaningless because you will appeal. I know that you will appeal. And I also have read the book, Tell the Truth and Shame the Devil by Gerard Menuhin. So this judge was saying this in the court, basically telling the world that the judge knew what was going on. And Ursula Haverbeck did not go to jail.
Yeah, I think there has been some confusion. I'm looking at an article here published by the Jewish Telegraph Agency, and this is from November 29th. And the headline, Nazi Grandma, they call her the Nazi Grandma. These people are so ridiculous. Nazi Grandma in Germany will serve jail time. The octogenarian known as the Nazi Grandma will serve 14 months in a German prison for Holocaust denial after losing an appeal on one of several convictions. Ursula Haverbeck, 89, was sentenced Tuesday by a district appeals court in Detmold for repeatedly denying the Holocaust, which is a crime in Germany, not just Germany, but dozens of countries in Europe and also other places around the world. Let me just read this article real quick. It's very brief. In September 2016, a court in Detmold sentenced Haverbeck to 8 months in jail on charges of sedition after she said Jews were never exterminated in Auschwitz. She also reportedly made offensive comments in the courtroom. At the end of the trial, she handed out leaflets to journalists, the judge, and prosecutor titled, "Only the Truth Will Set You Free," which also included denial of Nazi atrocities during the Holocaust. In response, the court increased her sentence by several months. A year ago, Haverbeck was sentenced by a Hamburg court to 10 months in prison for Holocaust denial after saying on television that the Holocaust was the biggest, quote, the biggest and most sustainable lie in history. What a great quote that is. She made the statements to reporters outside the trial of former SS guard Oscar Gröning, who was found guilty for his role in the murder of 300,000 at Auschwitz. Haverbeck, who was dubbed, quote-unquote, the Nazi grandma by the German media, has been convicted and sentenced to prison on several other occasions for writing articles denying the Holocaust and incitement to hate. She has appealed all the decisions, however, and has yet to spend any time in jail.
Ah, they got that part right.
At the very last sentence of the article, right? So you have to read all the way down just to discover she's never even spent time in jail. Also, there was an article covering this exact same case, this decision that, you know, this judge made that, you know, basically denied her one of her appeals. And in that article, it talks about how she's appealing this loss of an appeal, right? So she's appealing this decision as well. So it sounds like she has some legal options where she can challenge this and appeal all of these decisions. And it seems to me like she's using these opportunities to just boldly declare the truth and to, you know, give all this information to the journalist covering the trial, to the judge even, to the prosecutor, saying, hey, look, you know, read this. This is the truth. The Holocaust is not it's a fake narrative. It's a Jewish concocted narrative. And she's right. She's very bold. I got a lot of respect for her. She's an incredible woman.
Oh, for sure. She's one of my heroes too. And yes, in Germany, the newspaper headlines will read Nazi Oma, you know, that article. Yeah, for sure. The Jewish press, I mean, they would like us all to be quivering and quaking in our boots and lest we try to imitate her behavior. And I should just give a little bit of background of what she did for years before all these court cases started happening. She wrote letters, just innumerable letters to, you know, all levels of government, to all the Jewish organizations. She just wrote and wrote and wrote for about 5 years. She asked them, where did these 6 million Jews die? Where did they die? I mean, it was by then known that the numbers at Auschwitz had been decreased hugely, and you know, things were being disproven about the official claims there, and she just kept on writing, where did they die? And nobody answered. So she had said to them, well, if I don't get any answers, then I guess if there's no place where they died, then they didn't die, then it didn't happen, right? So that's kind of how she did her homework. She didn't just come out of the blue and start declaring things. And she really has done her homework. I have watched some of her videos, and the research that she has done is just so thorough. down to, you know, figuring out or learning what the Kommandanturbefehle in Auschwitz, those are the instructions or the rules for the guards and the people, how they were supposed to treat the prisoners and whatnot. And, you know, that's another thing that doesn't get taught in history class, is that there were very, very strict rules about how the prisoners in Auschwitz were to be treated. And I assume in the other camps as well, but Auschwitz, it's very, very well documented. And these rules about how to treat the prisoners, they were thorough. And if the officers broke those rules, they would be punished. And in fact, there are documentations of at least two German officers who were executed by the German army. So they executed their own for mistreating prisoners. So for sure, atrocities happen. Atrocities happen in war on all sides. But there were very strict rules about this. But so this, of course, does not get.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's the thing. I mean, I think it's entirely accurate to say that the official narrative of World War II, especially as it relates to the alleged Holocaust, it's almost literally the exact opposite of what truly transpired, right?
It's not,
it's a total inversion, and there's many ways to demonstrate this.
Yes, John, it's not even almost a total inversion. It is.
No,
a
it
total
is.
Inversion.
I mean, it truly is. And you know, you were talking about how in these camps, the Germans had very, they wanted to treat the people that they were in charge of, all these inmates at these various concentration camps, who were, you know, largely workers. I mean, these people were there. They needed to use their labor to advance the war effort and to keep industry going, etc. And they wanted to treat these people with dignity, with respect. They wanted to maintain healthy and sanitary living conditions. And you're right. I mean, German guards that didn't live up to these standards were in fact punished. And I remember reading about this. And I mean, I've read it in multiple sources, including from Ursula Haverbeck. She gave an interview where she talked all about this that I remember watching. You could probably find the interview on YouTube. I can't remember who exactly she was speaking with. I'm pretty sure it was a German newspaper, and there was English subtitles, I remember. But she gets into this.
There's the Panorama interview.
Yeah,
I'll just
that's what it
throw
was.
That in there. That's a television. It was a television program, and it was after that interview that she was then first charged. As far as I know, that's when it all started. I think they kind of entrapped her with that. It was a mainstream television, so probably millions of Germans watched that interview. It's 45 minutes long or so. And yes, it has subtitles, so people can find that. Just put in Panorama interview Ursula Haverbeck into their search bar, and they will find that.
It's very powerful. It's very, very good. Very, very much worth watching for sure if you have not seen it. But yeah, she gets into this. And also there's a book by Dr. Nicholas Kahlerstrom and Dr. Jim Fetzer. I think Jim Fetzer wrote the foreword to the book and I think edited it as well. But the book is called Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust Myth and Reality. Are you familiar with that book?
Yes.
Yeah, it's very good. It's very, very good. Very easy to read. I think he does a great job of explaining just breaking down the fake Holocaust narrative and explaining how it's not even possible. But he also talks about this, and he cites German, you know, policy papers, you know, where they're saying, look, you know, we got to treat these people right. And if any of them get hurt or if they get sick, we're launching an investigation. We're, you know, possibly punishing those responsible or those who let this happen or allowed this to happen or whatever. So, I mean, yeah, they were very strict. And again, it's the total opposite of the Hollywood version of the Nazis as these evil monsters who hated Jews and hated other non-whites. They're presented as like white supremacists, etc. Hitler certainly is. And it's just not true at all. I mean, these were the most dignified and honorable men that Western civilization has produced, in my opinion. They're certainly up there with some of the top white people in all of history. I mean, these guys were very honorable and righteous and knew what they were doing, and we should be proud of that. And they've just been totally slandered. It's really a travesty.
Yes, absolutely. You're right that they, and the soldiers as well, like in the soldiers in the field, there were very, very strict rules. And the opposite occurred with the Red Army, led by, you know, Jewish commanders and whatnot. I mean, they were basically told to rape and pillage and destroy utterly the, whether, you know, civilians. And this was it, like, it really is the opposite, the very opposite as what we are told by Hollywood and by the history books.
Oh yeah, absolutely. In fact, I was trying to see if I could find, we might have even mentioned it last time we talked, Germany Must Perish, the book written by Theodor Kaufmann, who was like a Jewish, I think he was a Jewish writer. He was involved in, I think, like Broadway plays, if I'm not mistaken. But he wrote a whole book talking about how he wanted to see the total destruction of Germany. And this is just one example of many. I mean, there were Jewish communists, Jewish Bolsheviks writing similar things. Ilya Ehrenberg, I think, was the guy's name over in the Soviet Union, and he was Jewish. And he was writing, you know, basically orders to his soldiers, you know, at the front line, you know, rape German women, kill German civilians, you know, degrade them. I mean, you know, that's essentially what he was telling them to do. And they did. So we have, you know, Soviet Jews, we have American Jews, British Jews, all openly advocating the total destruction, the total annihilation, the total genocide of the German nation, of the German people. And, you know, they've convinced us that it was the opposite, that it was the Germans who wanted to kill all the Jews, when it's, I mean, just totally the opposite. It's insane.
Yes. I'd like to point out a very important thing here, too, that these wars that were instigated, they were instigated, and the European people were manipulated into killing each other. And this is by the Jewish elite, the Jewish powers. They manipulated the European people to attack and kill each other. These are, you know, brothers killing brothers, essentially, like in terms of, you know, the English, the French, the Americans. Many of these Americans were of German ancestry, and then they're incited and manipulated to think that Germany is the enemy, and then to kill each other. It's like the arm stabbing the heart. This is actually one of Alfred's memes that he put into his latest speech there at the Rhine Wiesen, the meadows there. And you know, it's like if you're manipulated and mind controlled into putting a knife in your hand and stabbing yourself in the heart. This is what happened with Europe, and we need to understand what happened to make that happen, and who was behind all that. And that is the real crux of the matter. And now the aftermath of it, this false narrative about the Holocaust is keeping this narrative of basically the destruction of the European peoples going with this false Holocaust narrative. It's like the linchpin of our times.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well said. And that is a topic I definitely want to address in some length here. Before we do, you were talking about how the Jews were really responsible for instigating all these wars in Europe, World War I, World War II. And I think you can make a very strong case. I mean, I don't think it was just the Jews, right? I mean, they certainly played a key role, especially in the events leading up to World War II. And ultimately, I think these wars were fought on behalf of Jewish interests. I mean, largely, that Jewish interests prevailed, you know, with both World War I and World War II. I think that's very, very, very obvious, very clear at this point. But today, in a modern context, the wars that the United States is involved in the Middle East, it's not just the United States. Canada is involved with NATO, and, you know, a lot of European countries in NATO. You know, we're occupying Iraq, we're in Afghanistan, we're in all these countries all over the Middle East. And all of these wars today, the whole global war on terrorism, are a direct result of Jewish power and influence. There's no doubt. These are Jewish wars fought on behalf of Jewish interests, first and foremost.
That's right, John.
And I mean, 9/11, the event that was used to kickstart this whole global war on terrorism, 9/11 was organized and executed by Jewish criminals in the state of Israel and in the United States primarily.
That's right.
9/11 to kickstart all of these fraudulent wars, and they're using Western white men and women and our capital and our human resources to go over and kill all these poor backwards people thousands of miles away from our, you know, from our homeland. It's absolutely insane.
Yes, it is. And when you mentioned that, you know, it's not all just Jews, but what happens is that, you know, you get the Shabbos Goy, like the Gentiles who are manipulated into participating in this. But it really is Jewish interests that are being served all the way. And yes, we have our puppet leaders who might not be Jewish themselves, but they have their Jewish advisors. And it doesn't really matter who is actually the figurehead if they are being utterly and totally controlled by their Jewish masters who are hidden. I mean, they do like to veil themselves in many ways, not just in the literal sense of not being the actual figurehead at the top many times, but, you know, they change their names individually. They also change their name as a group. I mean, this is kind of the modus operandi for the Jewish people since thousands of years, actually.
Yes, indeed. I wanted to mention one other article relating to our chat about Ursula Haverbeck. In the article I read from the Jewish Telegraph Agency, it talks about how she was at Oscar Gröning's trial. And I'm looking at Carolyn Jaeger's website right now, and Germany is demanding that this guy, Oscar Gröning, spend 4 years in prison. This man is 96 years old, and they want to send him to prison for 4 years for his alleged crimes at Auschwitz.
Doesn't it
show you how visceral the hatred is of Germans and of white people more generally that the Jews have? And I mean, look at how Germany is persecuting one of its own. Their minds have been so poisoned and their society has been so corrupted that they would go after an old man like this, who I don't even know all the details of what he was involved with at Auschwitz. I mean, certainly he did not kill, you know, mass murder 300,000 people like they're saying or whatever.
No.
I guess I don't know all the details, but still, I mean, this guy probably did nothing wrong. And they ended up, during his trial, he ended up, like, confessing to all of this, incredibly. You know,
well,
he kind of backed down. Or go ahead, maybe, you probably know more about this.
At 96 years of age, and, I mean, are we all really in full, you know, do we have all our capacities still at that time? And have we been subjected to decades of you know, indoctrination after the fact? And I mean, this is just so ridiculous. And they do this over and over again, going after these 90-year-olds or 95-year-olds or 98-year-olds, who some of them were mere clerks, or, you know, they're like, it is just a sign of the desperation to keep this false narrative alive by then making a big splash in the mainstream media about, oh, we caught another evil Nazi and we're putting him in jail. Like, oh my goodness. Like, it just speaks for itself. This is quite despicable. These acts of, you know, so-called revenge against something that the Germans didn't even do. And it's just based on, you know, trying to keep this narrative alive 24/7 with the Hollow Hoax.
Yes, it is 24/7 every single day. I mean, it's insane how much you hear about the Holocaust. And this is, again, why I think it's an issue that really can't be avoided, you know, in the overall struggle for, you know, the future of the white race, for the future of truth and sanity to prevail in our world. I mean, we have to address this topic because it is. It really is the linchpin of the entire New World Order agenda. And I actually just watched a video. You can find it. I posted it at therealistreport.com. It was published by Alison Chablos, who I believe is an English woman, correct? Do you know Alison?
Yes, we have met, and I actually had the great honor of playing music with her at a couple of events here in Canada when she was doing her satirical songs, and I accompanied her with my violin. It was great fun. And she's a wonderful, wonderful, very intelligent woman who's got a great sense of humor as well. And her satire is just a little too much for the the Jewish powers, they don't like that, you know.
So yes, she's been shut down. Yeah, she's been shut down, and yeah, and certainly persecuted, no doubt. Yeah, she's got a cool YouTube channel. I've wanted to interview her. I've tried to interview her, but our time zones are so different. It kind of makes it difficult. But I've heard her on Andrew Carrington Hitchcock's podcast program, and she is very talented. Her videos are excellent. She made a parody song that got her in a lot of trouble, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know how long ago it was.
It's called Survivors with brackets around it. You can find it still, pretty sure. And if you're in Europe listening to this, a lot of these things get censored over there, but I think we can still find it. So anyway, it's great. It's a really great song. She's written quite a few of these wonderful satirical songs.
Yes, exactly. And her recent video is titled "Revisionism is at the Heart of Our Struggle for Freedom." And it's a great, an excellent video. It's like 16 minutes. Half of it is Vincent Renoir, I believe is his name. He's a French revisionist.
Yes.
And I think Allison, she speaks French fluently. Didn't she teach French, I believe?
Yes. She has, I think she was in Switzerland for a number of years, and I can't remember exactly where all she has lived, but yes, she's definitely fluent.
Right. Yeah. So in this video I'm mentioning features a pretty lengthy segment by him, and it's great. It's very much worth watching. And the main point is that, again, the fake Holocaust narrative and everything that goes with it is really at the heart of the New World Order agenda. It is used to advance Jewish interests and to delegitimize white racial identity. You know, if you identify as white and care about white interests and the future of white people, you're a Nazi who wants to kill 6 million Jews. I mean, that's the way it goes. It's absurd, but it's so effective.
And what they've done with the German guilt, which has been foisted on the Germans for decades and decades, they've extended it to white guilt. The whites are guilty because they didn't do enough to stop the so-called Holocaust of the Jews. And the white guilt, of course, it's being just pounded onto us by the false history of not just the Holocaust, but pretty much everything else in our history has been twisted and turned and changed to make the white people want to bring on their own collective suicide. I mean, many people who have not woken up to these lies, they basically think, oh yeah, that's good. If we disappear off the face of this earth, we've basically done all the bad things on the face of this earth, and nothing could be further from the truth. And this is part of it. The agenda, this white guilt, and that stems right out of this centerpiece, the Holocaust.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you're also right in the fact that Jews literally do blame the entire Western world for the Holocaust. It's not just Germany. America, France, the UK, you know, we didn't do enough to prevent this from happening. In fact, I wrote an article over 2 years ago entitled "Top Jewish Leader Claims Entire Western World Culpable for the Holocaust." And I quote Ron Lauder, who was the president of the World Jewish Congress, or I think he actually still is the president of the World Jewish Congress. He was back in 2015, and he gave a speech right around, I think it was like the opening of, or not the opening, but the commemoration of like Auschwitz or something like that. He was at some big Jewish event, you know, dealing with the Holocaust, and he basically argued this. He argued that the entire Western world was responsible. And let me see if I can find the exact quote. He said that there were few countries that didn't bear some culpability for the crime of the Holocaust, and he even singled out the United States for shutting its door to Jews desperately trying to leave. Quote, "We know the perpetrators, but they were not just Germans and Austrians. There was complicity in practically every country of Europe." Can you imagine?
You were already on it 2 years ago. That's great, John, that you did that article. And from when was that quote? Like, how was that around that time that this guy was saying these things?
Yeah. This was in 2015. This quote comes directly from an article published by a Jewish news outlet called The Allgemeiner.
Oh, yeah.
And oh, that's what it was. It was the 70th anniversary of, you know, the Holocaust or whatever, the commemoration of the Holocaust. And he was giving a speech. 70 years after Holocaust, we are descending into the same dangerous hell that we found ourselves before. I mean, they're always talking about, like, the threat of the rising tide of anti-Semitism and racism and hatred. They're always going on and on about this, and they always go back to the fake Holocaust narrative to kind of back that up. And
yeah.
It's always invoked. I mean, anything that the Jews want, they just invoke the Holocaust, and they basically get it. And
that's right.
It's really – it's so insulting, you know, knowing what I know and reading stuff like this. It's very triggering. It's like the nerve of these people is just unbelievable, you know? And to think that you know, everyone is so afraid of these people. You know, these Jews can just carry on like this and say these things about us, and everyone's too damn afraid to even say anything or even to think critically about it, you know?
That's right. A result of lifetimes of indoctrination and manipulation of our minds. And it just goes on and on. And it really is, everything is inverted. And I mean, let's just go back to what Jesus Christ said to them back then, is ye are of the devil, your father, the devil. I mean, that he was talking to the Jews, who I think were called the Pharisees at the time. But that was the same group of people, and he threw them out of the temple, the moneylenders. He threw them out, and who are the moneylenders to this day? I mean, this has been going on for thousands of years, and it started way before 2,000 years ago as well. It started many thousands of years ago. And what they have done, too, is erase history, and they are in the process of erasing our history now, not just by inverting everything and telling us lies about, you know, World War II, but they are erasing our history. And I do believe that this has happened in the past, that there have been great civilizations before that have been erased in terms of, you know, the history. And, you know, sometimes I've talked to people who are engaged in what they call alternative archaeology, which is, of course, very suppressed, another field that's very suppressed, because they discover things that don't fit the narrative that we are all supposed to believe.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. Can you kind of elaborate on that a little bit? Like the alternative archaeology, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, people who find evidence, for instance, in North America, like were there actually white people here way before? And also New Zealand. I had somebody contact me from New Zealand. He was digging up some archaeological evidence that the Maoris didn't like at all. So they were actually kind of combining forces with the current, you know, governing forces to suppress this type of information, because the Maoris didn't like this, that there might have been white people there before the Maoris. I mean, this kind of alternative archaeology is showing evidence that it could very well be that white people were in many parts of the globe way before what we have in our understanding now, you know. So I don't really know enough in detail to talk at length about it, but it is something that I would encourage your listeners to explore this, that this, you know, we really have been lied to about pretty much everything, including this long-term history of the white people.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I am familiar with some of this information. Like you, I don't know enough to really talk too much about it. But, you know, I've read and seen some interesting videos. And the Barnes Review actually covers this pretty well. As you said, you know, alternative archaeology and study of like ancient migrations and stuff like that. And yeah, I think there is a lot of evidence to show that, for example, in America, there were white people here centuries ago, well before Columbus allegedly discovered it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it's a topic again that I don't focus too much on or read too much about, but it is fascinating. And I think there's definitely something to it. I mean, at this point, I think it's pretty fair to say that the Jews have weaponized all of our history. I mean, none of our history is presented accurately, you know, in the mainstream educational establishment, certainly in the mainstream media. I mean, you really have to kind of do your own research and consult alternative perspectives to kind of get to the bottom of things.
Definitely. I mean, it also extends to the religions of the world and who actually manipulated or created some of the major religions now, and either manipulated them or subverted them or even created them outright in order to bring about our own destruction. I mean, there are some very basic tenets within the major religions that do lead directly to our own destruction, and some major deceptions right at the core of these religions, you know. So anyway, that's another topic that I'd like to learn more about. I am kind of starting to explore these things, and the fact that you know, when we were children, we rejected our Catholic upbringing, but I think we threw the baby out with the bathwater in so doing, which is now what I'm really you know, exploring now, this aspect of it. I mean, there's a reason why the Bolsheviks burned down all the churches in Russia. I should say all the places of worship except the synagogues. They were left untouched, but all the other churches were burnt down. Religion was forbidden for the people. Now, why would they do that? Why would they do that if this wasn't an important aspect of getting control over the people and making them fearful and whatnot? I mean, if you have a faith in something larger than yourself, you're much more, it's going to be a lot harder to control you by the use of fear and this kind of thing. So anyway, these are things that I'm exploring now a lot deeper. And yeah, that's an my ongoing journey right now.
Well, good for you. Yeah, there's plenty of stuff to research and to learn about. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to read one more quote, and I may have even read this the last time you were on the podcast, and I've certainly read it on other podcasts, but I think it kind of, once again, undermines how central the fake Holocaust narrative is to the whole New World Order agenda, which is a Jewish agenda to destroy white nations primarily, but all genuine, you know, ethnic distinctions are under assault, under attack. And, you know, it's the New World Order agenda is really just about Jewish supremacy, Jewish political, economic, and cultural supremacy in the West. And again, this narrative is used to advance this. And this comes,
hello?
I just wanted to read a brief quote from a guy named Ian Kagedon. He was the former National Director of Government Relations of Brunei Brith in Canada. And he wrote an op-ed for the Toronto Star back in 1991 titled "Memory of the Holocaust Central to New World Order." That is the title of his op-ed.
Again, wow, there it
Memory
is.
Of the Holocaust Central to New World Order. And he says, quote, "The Holocaust stands as Western civilization's greatest failure. It was a natural outcome of centuries of racism and of anti-Semitism. To deny the Holocaust is to deny racism's capacity to undercut our civilization's basic values and to destroy democracy. Achieving our quest of a new world order depends on our learning the Holocaust lessons." I mean, there you go, guys. This is a Jewish man writing this, you know, a very powerful, influential Jewish man who I don't know if he's still around. I know he was the national director for B'nai B'rith in Canada, but again, this is from 91.
It's amazing. I mean, it's important to understand New World Order, what that actually means. I mean, that's basically you could translate that into the Jew World Order, which is one world government and enslavement of humanity, or what would be left of humanity if they get their way.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of explaining that, and I think when our connection was lost, yeah, I mean, that is what the New World Order is. It is basically a Jewish plot to enslave the entire world politically, economically, and culturally.
And
and really a way to, or an agenda to kind of destroy any genuine national or, you know, like racial distinction. And again, they use the Holocaust to do this. I mean, think about like they're always talking about the lessons of the Holocaust. You know, what can we learn from the Holocaust? And it's always, you know, we have to have quote unquote tolerance and diversity and multiculturalism. And these are all just code words for, you know, less white people.
Exactly. You know,
it's a way to delegitimize and destroy white racial identity. And to justify, you know, massive non-white immigration into the West and, you know, kind of just to end criticism of Jews. I mean, you can't talk about Jews critically because of the fake Holocaust narrative, you know?
Yeah, John, it's code words. I like how you put that. They're code words for basically anti-white or white genocide. And they're like marked cards. That's actually something my brother came up with, that all these weaponized words or these code words, as you put it, they are marked cards. So if you're playing with a deck of cards where the cards are marked, then you have no way of you know, you lose either way, right? So because the cards are marked. So that's what that is, code words. Now, you brought up that, you know, they part of the destruction of us is cultural. And I wonder if this might be a good time to segue into talking about the degradation of our culture.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I know you recently wrote about this over on your website, which is, by the way, freespeechmonica, Monica with a K, .wordpress.com. And I'll of course, link that when I post this podcast program, so you can find it over on my website. But yeah, let's talk about this subject. I mean, again, you recently wrote about it, and it's something that, you know, I'm always going on and on about, you know, how the Jews promote cultural and artistic degeneracy and just crap in our faces all the time.
Exactly. And when, you know, I have my own personal experiences with it through music, and I was lucky enough to get quite a lot of exposure to the classical music world when I was a child. And I always felt like this in the middle of the program, they would put the modern piece in there, and the modern pieces, just more often than not, were really kind of ugly. And I always remember thinking, well, I guess, you know, we have to listen to that because we have to give these modern composers a chance. But I always wondered why they couldn't make beautiful music like the older classics, you know, like Haydn or Beethoven or Vivaldi or Mozart, you know. And I just thought, well, I guess we have to put up with that to get the good stuff. But I always had this feeling like, why can't they make beautiful music? Maybe they've run out of, you know, notes or something. I mean, I was really young. I didn't really understand it. And so there was that. And then, you know, later, seeing the controversies around some of the art pieces that were promoted as good art. And there was that big controversy with the National Art Gallery in Ottawa. So the National Art Gallery of Canada buying a piece. And this was, in the 1990s for $1.76 million. And it was just three vertical stripes, like blue, red, blue. And that's all there was to it. And it was a gigantic piece, you know. So anyway, of course, the Canadian public were in an uproar, and there were lots of, you know, phone-in talk shows, and people would phone in and just couldn't understand how the gallery, the National Art Gallery of Canada, could spend all this money and said, hey, anybody could paint that. Just give us the paint and the canvas and we'll do it. And of course, then all the critics, you know, they'd be talking about, well, you know, people just don't understand it and it's this and that and blah, 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 blah. And so the mainstream media, they're all in cahoots with this. The museum directors, the art gallery directors, they're all in cahoots with this. So pretty soon the public is told, well, we're just too stupid to understand this stuff. So we're kind of taught to not trust our own sensibilities, our own instincts. And so it goes, you know, and this has been going on for a long, long time. And I did a little bit of research on that, and I wrote a piece, and I published it on my website. And anyway, I was just really happy and refreshed to see the response. I got lots of people writing to me about it and just agreeing wholeheartedly and being kind of relieved that somebody actually wrote about it like this. And you know, it's time to call the emperor has no clothes on. It's time to call them out on this. Like, And then I found out that this is actually their policy. It's not just, you know, this natural progression or evolution. No, it's the policy of the Jews to uglify our culture, to degrade our culture, to lead us to believing that European culture is not good, to you know, erode our pride in our own culture. This is all very, very deliberate. It's planned. And this is the outcome of it, is these giant paintings that was bought for, you know, under 2 million. And then, you know, in recent years, some other critic says, oh, wow, what a good investment that was. It's now worth 40 million. Well, excuse me, who says it's worth 40 million now? Oh, I guess it's the Jewish critics and the mainstream media parrots this. And then the gallery that's, you know, maybe got a Jewish director is going to pay for that. Like, no. Who says? Come on, let's call them out on this.
I totally agree. Yeah. And I'm looking at the painting that you're referring to. And it's, yeah.
Voice of fire. Voice of fire.
Yeah. The two blue stripes and the red one in the middle. And this is what's so infuriating about this. This is psychological warfare. This is like psychological terrorism, to where these Jews get up there and they put this painting up there and they tell you, look at how beautiful this is. This is very, very, you know, high class, and this is what art is, and this is great. And it's a piece of crap. You know, it's trash. It's not even art. You know, this is just a direct assault on our minds. And, you know, you're right. This absolutely is a policy, a communist policy, a cultural Marxist policy that Jews have been doing since, you know, the 1940s, 1950s.
And actually before that, because that's what Hitler wanted to shut down as well, was this degeneracy that was happening, especially in Berlin and other cities as well, I presume. But Berlin was kind of the hotbed for this degeneracy that was happening. And Hitler wanted to get rid of that. And, you know, he did instigate some burning of books, but these were the pornography books and whatnot. This was pornography that he was burning. And, of course, the history books have twisted that and turned it upside down as well to say, oh, Hitler, you know, did all this book burning. Well, no, excuse me. Just last year, who was it that did actual book burning? You know, Jeff Bezos at Amazon.com just overnight got rid of a whole bunch of titles of Holocaust revisionist books. And they did literally, I think, incinerate some of those. I'm not exactly sure about that, but I mean, Amazon, you know, the biggest book retailer in the world, and so you could still get these books elsewhere, but really if Amazon gets rid of them on their site, you basically make it harder to get these books. So really, once again, everything gets twisted and turned upside down.
Yeah. And you know what, you have a quote here from like the communist goals that apparently, yes, appeared in the American Congressional Record, and this is a direct policy that the communists were pursuing. Quote, control art critics and directors of art museums. They wanted to control these people, and again, they pretty much do. Our plan is to promote ugliness, repulsive, meaningless art. And that's exactly what they've been doing for years. Think about how degraded music has become, for example. You can still find good music out there, don't get me wrong, but the stuff that's on the radio, like the pop culture stuff, is so evil, degenerate, satanic even. I mean, it's very, very bad.
Yes, I agree.
Yep. And I mean, again, this is a Jewish run industry, so let's be serious about who's behind all of this.
Yeah. If someone came to this earth, you know, from outer space and just landed and looked at some of the degenerate art in the galleries and some of this horrible noise that is being passed off as music, they would honestly just shake their heads in disbelief and wonder at how did we let this happen to us? Like, how can we be told that this, you know, this vertical three stripes piece is supposed to be some meaningful, you know, thing, and we're told, well, we're just too stupid to understand it, but so we go along with it. How can this have happened? I mean, somebody that has just landed on the earth and sees this would just really scratch their heads in wonderment and at how this all happened.
Yes, indeed. And you had mentioned how Hitler was really keen to this and kind of recognized the very subversive and destructive role that Jews were playing in the arts. And he writes extensively about this in Mein Kampf and really wanted to put an end to this. I mean, this was a total affront to him as a European artist. I mean, Hitler himself was an artist, right? And
Yes, he was a very good artist.
Exactly, yeah. And I mean, think about the long history of European art and culture. It's very beautiful. It's very sophisticated. And look at what the Jews have turned it into.
Yeah, one could just cry about it. It is very, very sad and tragic what has happened to the art and culture and the degeneration of it, the very deliberate degeneration of it. We have to call it out, name the names, name the perpetrator of this degeneration and regain our spirit and our sense for beauty and regain the trust in ourselves that we can actually make a judgment on what is beautiful and what is not beautiful ourselves and not rely on some art critics to tell us these things.
Yes, exactly. Well, you know, I think that's why the Jews hate Hitler and other people that just tell the truth about the Jews, like in a modern context. You know, anybody that's critical of Jews, you know, just gets attacked and persecuted, etc. But I think that's really what is behind this just absolute hatred and contempt for Hitler, for National Socialism, and for Germany during this period, because they were openly calling the Jews out and identifying them as a subversive, you know, evil people that they really are, as the very conniving and just subversive people that they were, you know, how they were controlling German society. They were exposing this and explaining it to people. And, you know, that's one thing. You know, this is all being made very clear. And I think that's happening today as well, not on the scale that it was in Germany, but that's really kind of what our goal is, right, is to articulate these views and explain to people what the Jews are up to.
Absolutely.
And that's what they absolutely cannot stand, you know?
Yeah, we do have to connect the dots for people and really work overtime on this, because it's an existential threat to us. And really, if we lose, then nothing else will have any meaning. We have to connect the dots and help people to wake up to this. And people are waking up in droves. And I keep hammering this home for people that a lot more people understand this than is visibly apparent, because of course people are afraid to speak publicly about it, because then, you know, they might lose their jobs or get ostracized and vilified. And you and I have both experienced some of these things in terms of, you know, the ritual defamation that takes place and whatnot. However, there is beginning to be a critical mass, I think, like people at all levels of society and all walks of life are waking up to this. I believe that in every community, in every village, every hamlet, there are people who understand and know. And I know what Alfred said in Germany, he feels that people at the highest levels and the police, certainly, that many of them are waking up to this. He experienced this recently at his talk where he broke all the rules and greeted them very friendly at the end when he walked through their lines, and they greeted him friendly back. I mean, there are many, many people at all these levels who understand, plus the judge that said openly when she gave her verdict for Ursula Haverbeck a number of weeks ago that she has read Gerard Menuhin's book, Tell the Truth and Shame the Devil. I mean, that was a message that she knows and understands. So, I mean, you know, they have to kind of just do the things that they do to keep their jobs, but they understand. And there is a zeitgeist shift. This is wonderful. We need to keep on this and keep it up. And I just try to encourage people to, you know, yeah, join us and get in
Absolutely.
With us. Because, yeah, it's a good time.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we really got to educate ourselves. I mean, that's the main thing. We need our ideas, our perspectives to prevail, because they're the truthful ones. I mean, we are telling the truth about this stuff, and we can prove it. We can demonstrate that what we're saying is 100% accurate. in many cases using Jewish sources and you know, quotes from Jews themselves. This is no secret. That's the thing. There really is no like secret conspiracy, you know, behind all of this. It's out in the open. People just
absolutely.
People just don't recognize it. It's never presented in this way. There's no clarity on these subjects. And, you know, there's becoming more and more clarity, right? I mean, that's, again, kind of what my goal is to make this all very clear to people. And, you know, I agree with you. I think things are certainly going in the right direction. And it's very sort of uplifting and fulfilling knowing that, you know, we're playing our role. We're doing what we can to advance this cause. You know,
yes,
I feel totally righteous doing this, you know, like I'm not doing anything wrong, even if I get persecuted, even if, you know, as you said, we both face some consequences for doing this stuff. But in the end, I know we're right. And I know that we're going to prevail.
Yes, we have truth on our side. And there's, I have absolutely no regrets, and I am very, very happy to be doing what I'm doing, and I will continue to do what I'm doing, because we have truth on our side. So what else is important, really?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Monica, very well said. This was another good conversation. We're just at the hour mark.
Yes.
And yeah, I think
it's a good time. To a good note to end on, I think, John. It's been just absolutely wonderful to speak with you, and very stimulating. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yes, absolutely. No problem. Thank you very much for coming on. It was a very good conversation. We'll definitely have to do it again. And I hope people check out your website, freespeechmonica.wordpress.com, correct?
Yes, that is absolutely right. And Monica with a K, like you said. And thanks again, John, for all the work you do. You do wonderful work.
All right. Thank you so much, Monica. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We will talk again real soon.